Good evening. I am Eric Wright, the director of the Haven Center at the University of Wisconsin and professor in the sociology department. Let me first just tell you briefly something about the Havens Center. The Haven Center was founded at the University of Wisconsin in 1985 to promote scholarship animated by progressive ideals of social justice and to create bridges between the world of the academy and the worlds of activism. It is named after the Wisconsin sociologist Eugene Havens, who died in 1984 after a career as an activist scholar, including work in the 1980s with the Sandinista government in Nicaragua on issues of land reform. His life and work embodied the kind of deep connection between activism and academics that the center hopes to encourage. In this spirit, the Haven Center established in 2004 an award for lifetime contributions to critical scholarship. Previous recipients were Francis Fox Piven and Howard Zinn. This evening, we honor Noam Chomsky, undoubtedly the best known and most influential American public intellectual in the world today, with this honor. By way of introduction, I would like to read a short passage from a powerful early political essay he wrote, The Responsibility of Intellectuals, published in the New York Review of Books in 1967 at the height of the Vietnam War. Intellectuals, Noam wrote, are in a position to expose the lies of governments, to analyze actions according to their causes and motives and often hidden intentions. In the Western world, at least, they have the power that comes from political liberty, from access to information and freedom of expression. For a privileged minority, Western democracy provides the leisure, the facilities, and the training to seek the truth lying hidden behind the veil of distortion and misrepresentation, ideology, and class interest, through which the events of current history are presented to us. It is the responsibility of intellectuals to speak truth and to expose lies. The essay then concludes this way. The question, what have I done, is one that we may well ask ourselves as we read each day of fresh atrocities in Vietnam, as we create or mouth or tolerate the deceptions that will be used to justify the next defense of freedom. In the over four decades since that publication, Noam Chomsky has steadfastly lived up to the responsibility of intellectuals posed in that essay, relentlessly exposing the misinformation and lies used to justify American military aggression around the world and the domination of our politics at home by conservative political forces. Tonight, we celebrate and honor Noam Chomsky's lifetime contribution to critical scholarship, both for his importance to our collective past and as a role model for being an engaged activist intellectual for our collective future. As is the symbolic custom in such events, we have a plaque. I am sure not the first plaque you have received, but perhaps the first one for lifetime contribution for critical scholarship. And thank you very much. Let us all welcome Noam Chomsky.
Well, I don't have to waste time saying what's obvious, how pleased and grateful I am for this honor. Which also offers an occasion to look back over the years. When I do so, what comes to mind with particular salience for me are the earliest years, in part because I've been thinking about them lately for other reasons, reasons that are somewhat unpleasant. I'm just old enough to have memories of Hitler's speeches on the radio 75 years ago, I didn't understand the words, but I couldn't fail to grasp the menace of the tone and the cheering mobs. The first political article I wrote was shortly after, in February 1939. It was right after the fall of Barcelona. I'm sure it was nothing particularly memorable. It was a fourth grade newspaper of which I was the editor and probably the only reader. Maybe my mother, I'm not sure. But I can recall a little of it, much more clearly than the few words I remember are the is the mood of fear and foreboding. It opened with the words, Austria falls, Czechoslovakia falls, and now Barcelona falls. This was immediately after the fall of Barcelona. And Spain with it a few months later. The words have somehow always stayed in my mind, along with the mood, the dread, the sense of the dark clouds of fascism gathering over Germany, then Europe, and no one could see how far beyond as a growing force of unimaginable horror. No one then could foresee the Holocaust, but just a few weeks earlier, Kristallnacht had taken place, and the desperate flight of refugees had been building up over several years, many of them unable to believe what was happening. In those days, those same childhood years, I also had my first experience with critical intellectuals, what are often called radical intellectuals, though they wouldn't be called intellectuals by the way the term is standardly used. It's standardly used to apply to people with status and privilege who are in a position to reach the public with thoughts about human affairs and concerns. And since privilege plainly confers opportunity, and opportunity confers responsibility, the question always arises as to how they're using that responsibility. Actually, the article that Eric just quoted was based on an article by Dwight MacDonald in the mid-1940s on responsibility of intellectuals, which was about the same topic. And those were very live questions in those years. Russell, Dewey, Eric Frum, MacDonald, Orwell, and others. Work that I soon became familiar with when I was a little older. But the radical intellectuals of my childhood, the first ones I met, were different. They were my working class relatives in New York. It was the Depression, so mostly unemployed. One uncle who was disabled was able to get a newsstand thanks to New Deal measures, which helped disabled people. And since he had employment, he was able to support a good deal of family. These relatives, most of them had very limited formal education. Uncle, who I mentioned, who was an enormous influence in my life. He never went past fourth grade. But it was one of the most lively intellectual circles I've ever had anything to do with, on the periphery as a child, of course. There were constant discussions about the latest concert of the Budapest String Quartet, of the controversies between Steckel and Freud, of every imaginable branch of radical politics, and also about activism. And the activism in those days was reaching pretty impressive heights, particularly significant by the mid-30s, were the sit-down strikes. That's just one step short of workers taking over factories, eliminating management and ownership, and radically changing the society. These are ideas that ought to be very much alive today. And if they're not, that's the fault of today's critical intellectuals, among others. Well, the rising labor activism aroused enormous concern in the business world, leading figures, I'm quoting, warned about what they called the hazard facing industrialists and the rising political power of the masses and the need to intensify the everlasting battle for the minds of men, and on like that. They at once, by the late 30s, were instituting fairly sophisticated programs, developed even more so later, to overcome this threat to order and discipline. It was put aside during the war, but taken up afterwards with extreme dedication and scale. There's quite good scholarship on this. It's worth bearing in mind that the United States is unusual among industrial societies in that it has an extremely class-conscious business community. It's constantly, relentlessly fighting a bitter class war. By 1941, I was spending a large part of my time in downtown Manhattan, gravitating to another group of radical intellectuals. These were in small bookstores on 4th Avenue, for those of you who know New York, down below 14th Street, below Union Square, either there or in the anarchist offices in Union Square, which was nearby. The bookstores were mostly refugees, many of them anarchist refugees from the 1936 revolution. They too didn't fit the standard formula for intellectuals. But if by intellectuals we mean people who think seriously about society, about human affairs, about the problems of life, with a background of knowledge and understanding, and consider carefully the problems and possible solutions, and then by that standard, they were indeed intellectuals. And they were quite happy to spend time with a young kid who was fascinated with the 1936 anarchist revolution. At the time, I was able to pick up a lot of material, which was quite interesting. I used a lot of it later on, 30 years later, when I was writing about the Spanish Revolution. Well, among those memorable of these materials is a collection of primary documents put together by peasant societies that were carrying out collectivization efforts. It was published in 1937 by the CNT, it's the anarcho-syndicalist union that happens to be celebrating its centenary this year. One particular contribution has resonated in my mind quite often. It's by peasants of the village of Membrilla. I'll quote parts of it. In the miserable huts of Membrilla live the poor inhabitants of a poor province. 8,000 people, the streets are not paved, the town has no newspaper, no cinema, neither a cafe nor a library. Food, clothing, and tools were distributed equitably to the whole population. Money was abolished, work collectivized, all goods passed to the community. Consumption was socialized. It was, however, a socialization of not of wealth, but of poverty. The whole population lived as a large family. Functionaries, delegates, the secretary of the syndicates, the members of the municipal council were all elected, and they acted as heads of family. But they were controlled because special privilege or corruption would not be tolerated. Membrilla is perhaps the poorest village in Spain, but it's the most just. These words capture with rare eloquence the achievements and the promise of the anarchist revolution, promise which is yet to be fulfilled. The achievements didn't just come from nowhere. They were the outcome of many decades of struggle, of experiment, brutal repression. As I mentioned, the CNT, which is behind a lot of it, is celebrating its centenary. And that also meant learning, so knowing how to go on. This experiment of creating a world of freedom and justice was crushed all too soon by the combined forces of fascism, Stalinism, and liberal democracy. The global power centers understood very well that they must unite to destroy this dangerous threat to subordination and discipline before they turned to the secondary task of dividing up the spoils among themselves. That's what we call the Spanish Civil War. But the revolution was over before the Spanish Civil War really took off, crushed. Well, in later years, I've sometimes been able to see firsthand, at least a little of the lives of poor people, like those of Membrilla, poor people often suffering brutal repression and violence. In the miserable slums of Haiti at the peak of the terror in the early 90s, supported by Washington, though the facts are still suppressed and highly relevant to today's tragedy in Haiti, or in refugee camps in Laos, where tens of thousands of people were huddled. They were driven from their homes, recently been driven from their homes by a CIA mercenary army that swept through northern Laos. This is after years of trying to survive in caves under a relentless bombing, at that point the heaviest bombing in history, which had nothing to do with the Vietnam War, incidentally. It's one of the gravest atrocities of modern history, I think, still largely unknown, and still killing many people because the land is saturated with unexploded ordnance. Or in Palestine or southeastern Turkey and many other places. Among these, particularly important to me for personal reasons, is southern Colombia, where right now campesinos, indigenous people, Afro-Colombians, are being driven from their devastated lands by terror and from many sources and by chemical warfare by us. Here it's called fumigation, as if we somehow have the right to destroy other countries on pretext that we manufacture. These are people capable of the most miraculous sympathy and humanity, despite the awful suffering in which we play a major part while usually looking the other way, though in this case, at least not in Madison, thanks to the work of the Columbia Support Group here. One of the things I learned in the anarchist bookstores and offices 70 years ago was that I had been wrong in taking the fall of Barcelona in 1939 to be the death knell for freedom in Spain. It was actually 2 years earlier, in May 1937, when the industrial working class was crushed by communist-led repression, and communist armies swept through the countryside, destroying the collectives, with the assistance of the liberal democracies, and with Hitler and Mussolini waiting in the wings. Well, a few years after that, I went off to graduate studies at Harvard, my first time away from home. There I had my first extensive experience with what's called the intellectual world, the elite intellectual world. Shortly after arrival, I went to the standard faculty-run party for incoming graduate students, and I was regaled by a very distinguished philosopher, I won't mention his name, with an account of the Depression, which he assured me had not taken place. It was a liberal fabrication, so there were no rag pickers coming to our door in the early 1930s trying to get some pennies to survive. And there were no women being beaten by security forces on strike outside a textile plant, which I passed by when I was maybe 5 years old on a trolley car with my mother. There were none of my unemployed working class relatives. A few businessmen might have suffered, but beyond that, nothing happened. It was perfectly obvious from Harvard Square that was the story. Well, unfortunately, that's not an exception. such attitudes are broader. I could mention other cases, some of them pretty ugly. But most of the people were Stevenson liberals, liberal Democrats. These are the people who applauded when Adlai Stevenson said at the United Nations that we have to defend Vietnam from what he called internal aggression, new concept that was invented. We have to defend them from the assault from within. That's what President Kennedy called it. And these are words that we hear again today. For example, last Sunday in the New York Times, where we read the following front page story. After the conquest of Marja in Helmand province, the Marines have collided with the Taliban identity so dominant that the movement appears more akin to the only political organization in a one-party town with an influence that touches everyone. We've got to reevaluate our definition of the word enemy, said the commander of the Marine Expeditionary Brigade in Helmand province. Most people here identify themselves as Taliban. We have to readjust our thinking so we're not trying to chase the Taliban out of Marja, we're trying to chase the enemy out. It's a subtle distinction, since the Taliban are the enemy. That's a familiar problem. It's a problem that's bedeviled the conquerors from way back. It's very familiar to the United States from Vietnam, for example. Back in the mid-60s, the leading U.S. government scholar ended up being head of the Indochina Archives at Berkeley. He wrote a widely praised book in which he lamented that the enemy within was, in his words, the only truly mass-based political party in South Vietnam, and any effort of ours to compete with it politically would be like a competition between a minnow and a whale. So we can't do that. We've got to find a way to overcome their political force by using our comparative advantage, which is violence, as we did successfully. Others have faced similar problems. For example, the Russians in Afghanistan in the 1980s. That was an invasion which elicited here the kind of outrage that we muster for the crimes of enemies. Middle East specialist William Polk, who was there, reminds us that the Russians, in his words, won many military victories. And through their civic action programs, they actually won over many of the villages. And in fact, as we know from reliable sources, they created substantial freedom in Kabul, particularly for women. But to go on with Polk, over the decade of their involvement, the Russians won almost every battle and occupied at one time or another virtually every inch of the country. But they lost the war. When they gave up and left, the Afghans resumed their traditional way of life. It's not exactly accurate. He's overlooking the fact that when the Russians left, the radical Islamist forces that the United States had organized with the help of Saudi Arabia and Pakistan ravaged the place. They were so devastating that the population welcomed the Taliban when they came in. And many of them are now what we call the government, the warlord government of Kabul. The dilemmas that are faced by Obama and McChrystal aren't quite the same as those faced by the Russians. The enemy who the Marines are trying to chase out of their own villages have virtually no outside support. The Russian invaders, in sharp contrast, were facing a resistance that received vital support from the United States, from Saudi Arabia, and from Pakistan. They were busy rounding up the most extreme radical fundamentalists they could find anywhere, arming them with advanced weapons, while carrying forward the program of radical Islamization of Pakistan. It's another one of Reagan's gifts to the world, along with Pakistani nuclear weapons. The goal of these U.S. operations was not to defend Afghanistan. That might have been a acceptable policy, but that was not the goal. The goal was explained most clearly by the person in charge, the CIA station chief in Islamabad. He was running the operations. He said the goal is to kill Soviet soldiers. He boasted that he loved this noble goal, making it very clear in his words that the mission was not to liberate Afghanistan, which was he didn't care about. Many of you are should be familiar with Zbigniew Brzezinski's somewhat similar boasts. By the early 1960s, I was pretty deeply engaged in anti-war activities. Details are informative. They tell us a lot about the intellectual, cultural climate in places like, say, liberal Boston, where I was. I'll skip that. But by 1966, my personal involvement was deep enough so that my wife went back to college after 17 years to get a degree. Had three kids to take care of, and it looked as if I might be facing a long prison sentence, which actually came very close. The trial was announced, but shortly after that it was canceled because of the Tet Offensive. It's a very significant event, which convinced the business community in the United States, the ones who fundamentally make the decisions, that the war was becoming too costly. And in any event, the major war aims had been achieved. It's another long story I won't go into. Well, after policy shifted, after the Tet Offensive and policy quickly shifted, it suddenly turned out that everyone in Cambridge had been a long-time opponent of the war, in deep silence, I should say. The Kennedy memoirists, you know, they're all pile of people who wrote memoirs at Camelot in the early 60s, they all rewrote them. They rewrote the memoirs. Radically revising. They were untroubled, and commentators were untroubled by the radical revisions or by the extensive documentation that the new tale that they were telling was completely false. The new tale was that Kennedy had been a dove and was trying to end the war and so on. The assassination prevented this noble effort. The evidence is just overwhelming, the documentary public and private evidence that he was kind of at the hawkish end of his administration. He knew that the war was very unpopular, so he figured we'd better get out of it pretty soon, but he insisted to the very end, you know, a couple days before the assassination, that we can't consider withdrawal before victory is assured. But even before the Tet Offensive, say 1966, 67, there were growing doubts in these circles, not doubts about right and wrong. Those are questions that don't arise when we're engaged in some activity somewhere, but rather about the question that does arise, namely the likelihood of success. Maybe a paradigm example was a widely read book by historian Arthur Schlesinger, one of Kennedy's advisors. He was beginning to be concerned by the 1966, so that victory might not be so easily at hand. Here's the way he put it. He said, "We all pray that the hawks will be right and that the surge of the day will bring victory. And if it does, we will be praising the wisdom and statesmanship of the U.S. government in gaining military victory." And then he went on to describe accurately what the victory would look like. Military victory while leaving the tragic country gutted and devastated by bombs, burned by napalm, turned into a wasteland by chemical defoliation, a land of ruin and wreck with its political and institutional fabric pulverized. So if that succeeds, we'll all be praising the wisdom and statesmanship of the American government. Remember, this is a liberal government we're talking about, and the liberal intellectuals. But he thought probably the escalation wouldn't succeed and it would prove to be too costly for ourselves, so perhaps strategy should be rethought. And after the Tet Offensive, it was rethought essentially under instruction by the business world. Well, not that much has changed today when, say, Obama is hailed as a leading principled opponent of the Iraq invasion because he said that it was a strategic blunder. Those aren't new ideas. You could read that. You could have read that in Pravda in the early 1980s. There were plenty of people in the Communist Party writing openly saying it's a strategic blunder to invade Afghanistan. We're not going to gain anything. It's going to cost us too much. We don't call that principled in that case, but we call it principled in our case, which is just an indication of how deeply rooted the imperial mentality is. Extirpating it is no easy task. Well, it's sad to say, but unfortunately it's not false, that within the dominant spectrum, attitudes like these, which you might call liberal imperialism, they're the good guys. There's a likely alternative. It's revealed by some of the most recent polls, some of them in the last few days. About half of voters say that the average Tea Party member is closer to their views than President Obama. Fewer select Obama. On virtually all issues, Republicans are, according to the polls, are trusted by the electorate more than Democrats, in many cases by double digits. Now, other evidence suggests that these polls are not recording trust, they're recording distrust. The level of anger and fear in the country is like nothing I can recall in my lifetime. By comparison, the 1930s, where the Depression was much deeper, we're sort of a period of hope. Somehow it's going to get better, we can do something about it. Not now. And since the Democrats are in power, and those are the attitudes, the revulsion over the current social and economic political world attaches to them. And unfortunately, these attitudes, though they, in some respects, surprising, given their scale and depth, they are understandable. For over 30 years, real incomes for the majority of the population have stagnated or declined. Social indicators, basic measures of the health of a society, they have steadily deteriorated since the mid-1970s. Before that, they grew, closely tracking growth, as you'd expect. But they've been declining. Their last figures are from a couple of years ago. It's back to 1960. These are in large part the consequences of very conscious decisions in the 1970s to radically modify the nature of the economy, financializing the economy. And that has a corollary. The corollary is the hollowing out of domestic production. It still goes on, but not here. Like the same managers and owners produce in Mexico or China or somewhere else. And that means no jobs. Well, what people see before their eyes and what's clearly fueling the anger and hatred is that the bankers who are primarily responsible for the current crisis and who were then saved from bankruptcy by the public, they're now reveling in record profits and huge bonuses, while official unemployment, which is way below actual unemployment, is at about 10%. In manufacturing industry, it is actually at depression levels, one in six. And the good jobs are not likely to return for the reasons I mentioned. People want some answers. Why is this happening to us? We're not living in third world. It's not the Stone Age. It's not third world conditions. But why is this happening in a rich society? They see plenty of wealth going into very few pockets. Probably record levels of inequality. They want to know why this is happening. And they are hearing answers from only one place. Talk radio, Fox News, Sarah Palin, they're giving them answers. And the answers actually have some internal coherence. I mean, I spend a lot of time listening to talk radio while I'm driving. And it's interesting, shouldn't be laughed at. The people involved may be complete cynics, but the people who call in aren't. They're sincere. They have grievances, they want answers, they're getting answers. And the answers are internally coherent, if you're willing to sort of suspend disbelief and forget what you know about the world. And it's not a joke, and enter into you know, kind of a world of irrationality and deceit, it does hang together. It's an answer. I think ridiculing Tea Party shenanigans is a serious error. It should be far more important. I think it is far more important to understand what lies behind this and to ask ourselves a question. Why are these justly angry people being mobilized by the extreme right and not by forces that did so quite successfully during my childhood in the days of the formation of the CIO and other constructive activism? Well, just take one illustration of the recent illustration of the operation of what you might call really existing market democracy, which doesn't have much to do with markets or democracy. Obama, his primary constituency is financial institutions. They have gained such dominance in the economy that the share of corporate profits has risen since the 1970s from a few percent to about a third, which is tremendous economic power. Now, they preferred Obama to McCain, and they largely bought the election for him. It's their funding that carried it at the end. And they expected to be rewarded. And that's why you put your man in office. And they were. But a few months ago, responding to the very visible rising anger, Obama began to criticize what he called the greedy bankers and so on, who had been rescued by the public. And he even proposed some measures to constrain some of the things they do. And punishment for this deviation was very swift. The major banks announced at once, very prominently, front page stories in the New York Times, that if this, they were going to shift their funding to Republicans if Obama persisted with this offensive rhetoric. Well, he heard the message. And within a few days, he informed the business press that bankers are, as he put it, fine guys. He singled out for special praise the chairs of the two leading beneficiaries of public largesse, J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, his friends, great guys. And he assured the business world that I, like most of the American people, don't begrudge people seek success or wealth. He's referring to the bonuses and the profits that are infuriating the public. He went on to say this is part of the free market system. Not inaccurate, the way free market is interpreted in state capitalist doctrine. Well, people see that, you know, not very happy about it. None of this ought to be surprising. There was an incorrigible radical who talked about it a couple of centuries ago. His name was Adam Smith, we've all heard of him. He observed that in 1776, that the principal, he was talking about England, of course. He said the principal architects of power, of policy in England, are the owners of the society. In his day, they were merchants and manufacturers. Today, the multinationals and financial institutions. And the principal architects of policy make sure that policy will attend scrupulously to their interests, however grievous the impact on the people of England, and even more so on the victims of what he called the savage injustice of the Europeans abroad. He was speaking primarily of British crimes in India. That was a primary concern of an old-fashioned conservative with moral values. It might take Diogenes to find them today. But he's basically right. That ought to be a truism. It's one of the few principles of political science that's overwhelmingly supported and obvious and denied, of course, like anything simple and revealing. There's a great deal of fevered discussion these days about whether or when the United States is going to lose its dominant position in global affairs to China and India, the rising world powers. And there's a particle of truth to these laments, but not much. A part that's partly based on serious misconceptions about debt and deficits and crucially the actual state of India and China, which is nothing like the image that's presented. But also, much more seriously, I won't go into that, the discussions are based on a very serious misconception of the nature of power and its exercise. In fact, several misconceptions. One of them is Adam Smith's truism, but there's another one which dominates scholarship and discussion on international affairs. In these areas, it's common to identify the actors in international affairs as states which pursue something called the national interest. That's some mystical notion that's uniform for the CEO of General Electric and the janitor who cleans the floors. And this national interest is totally divorced from the internal structure of power, quite distinct from Adam Smith. Well, Smith actually had a sharper eye. And his radical truism provides a useful corrective to all of this discussion. So bearing it in mind, we can see that there is indeed a global shift of power, though it's not the one that's occupying center stage. It's a further shift, a substantial further shift from the global workforce to transnational capital. It's been sharply escalating during the last couple of decades, so-called neoliberal period, the period here of financialization and deindustrialization. And the cost is pretty substantial. It includes working people in the United States and those suffering much more severely, like, for example, starving peasants in India, where peasant suicides are rising at about the same level as the number of billionaires, and millions of protesting, probably tens of millions of protesting workers in China, where the labor share of national income is declining even more rapidly than it is in most of the world. China is indeed playing a leading role in these global changes. It's become pretty largely an assembly plant for a regional production system. So Japan and Taiwan and other advanced Asian countries export parts and components to China. They provide most of the sophisticated technology, and Chinese labor assembles it and exports it. There was, give one example, there was a recent study of this by the Sloan Foundation, which took as one of their examples an iPod that costs $160, and they estimated that 4%, $4, that's like 2% of the value added, was added in China. It's counted as Chinese exports, but they're not doing much except putting it together. There's a lot of concern, read all over the place, about the U.S. trade deficit with China, which is growing enormously. But there's less emphasis, and practically none except in the business press, about the fact that the trade deficit with Japan and Taiwan is sharply decreasing. Well, that's part of the same regional production system. And U.S. manufacturers are right in the middle of it. They're following the same course, providing parts and components and technology for China, for them to assemble and export mostly back to the U.S. Well, for the what Smith called the principal architects of policy, for the financial institutions, the retail giants, you know, Walmart and so on, the ownership and management of manufacturing industries, and the various sectors closely related to this nexus of power, all of this is just heavenly, but not for American workers. But as Smith pointed out, their fate is not the concern of the principal architects of policy. Well, returning to the charges against the greedy bankers, we should recognize in fairness that they have a valid defense. They have a task. Their task is to maximize profit and market share. In fact, that's their legal obligation. If they don't do it, they'll be replaced by somebody who will. So that's an institutional fact, not because they're bad guys. Also an institutional fact is the inherent market inefficiency that you learn about in your first term of economics, an inefficiency that requires them to ignore what's called systemic risk. that is, the likelihood that the transactions that they enter into will harm the economy and the population generally. You don't take that into account when you make a market transaction. So they know full well, say the fine guys in Goldman Sachs, they know perfectly well that the transactions they enter into are likely to tank the economy. No, don't take a genius to figure that out. But these externalities, as they're called, are not their business, and they cannot be. Again, not because they're bad people, but for institutional reasons. It's also unfair to accuse them of irrational exuberance. It was Alan Greenspan's phrase in his brief recognition of reality during the artificial tech boom of the 1990s, late 90s. Actually, their exuberance and their risk-taking are quite rational in the knowledge that when the inevitable collapse comes, they can flee to the shelter of the nanny state, you know, clutching their volumes of Hayek and Friedman and Rand and so on, and they'll be paid off. The government insurance policy, which is always there in the background, that's why they put these guys in office, that's one of the many perverse incentives that magnify what are inherent market inefficiencies. They could be overcome by regulation, but that would have to be carried out by officials reflecting, acting for a different constituency, and not the constituency that actually puts them into office. Well, after the latest disaster occurred, the last couple of years, there was a discussion in, among leading economists about what was called an emerging consensus, that we must pay attention to the stability of the financial system as a whole and not just its individual parts. I happen to be quoting Barry Eichen Green, one of the most respected analysts and historians of the financial system. Two prominent international economists said that there's a growing recognition that our financial system is running a doomsday cycle. Whenever it fails, we rely on fiscal policies to bail it out. This response teaches the financial sector to take large gambles, to get paid handsomely, and don't worry about the costs. They'll be paid by taxpayers, the ones who are now flocking to the Tea Party movement. It'll be done through bailouts and a variety of other devices. And the financial system is therefore resurrected to gamble again and to fail again. The system is what's called a doom loop by the official of the Bank of England who's responsible for financial stability. It's understood, and it was understood years ago. In fact, in the late 90s, there was a book by two leading international economists called Global Finance at Risk, which discussed exactly this, the fact that the market inefficiencies of systemic risk are a doom loop, especially when magnified by the policies carried out by the architects of policy who owe their position to the people who own the society. So the regulation, to the extent it exists, is very thin. Well, financial crises are bad enough. A lot of people are suffering from them, but they're much worse things. And the same logic applies. About a year ago, the business world was pretty impressed by the success of the insurance companies and big pharma in destroying the possibility of any meaningful health reform in sharp defiance of the public will. And that's a pretty serious matter. I mean, not only for the people who suffer from the dysfunctional healthcare system, but even on narrow economic grounds. We're instructed constantly that we're supposed to deplore the deficit. Well, question about whether we should, but if we do, we should notice that about half the deficit is attributable to unprecedented military expenditures. They're going up under Obama, and most of the rest of the deficit is attributable to the increasing costs of the virtually unregulated, privatized healthcare system, which is being preserved. It's unique in the industrial world. It's also unique in the gifts that are given to drug companies, promised again by Obama, that's over the opposition of a mere 85% of the population in this case. Last August, Business Week had a cover story celebrating the victory of the health insurance industries. Of course, no victories ever enough, so they persisted in the struggle, gaining more, again, against the will of the large majority. That's another interesting story I'll have to put aside. Well, observing this victory, the American Petroleum Institute, backed it by the Chamber of Commerce and the other great business lobbies, announced very publicly, again, read it in the New York Times, that they were going to use the model of the health industry campaigns, the successful campaigns to destroy health reform, they were going to use that model to intensify their already quite substantial propaganda efforts to convince the public to dismiss concerns about anthropogenic global warming. Now, and they did, and that's been done with great success. Those who believe in this liberal hoax have been reduced to barely a third of the population. The executives who are dedicated to this task know as well as the rest of us that the liberal hoax is quite real and the prospects are pretty grim, but they're fulfilling their institutional role. The fate of the species is an externality that they ignore, and they must ignore to the extent that market systems prevail. So, you know, one part of their lives, they may care that the lives of their grandchildren and everything they own is going down to tube, but in the other part of their lives, they have to make sure that that happens. And that's what we're seeing in front of us right now. Well, don't want to go on too long, but one of the most moving and clearest articulations of the public mood, at least that I've seen, was written by Joseph Andrew Stack. You may remember that a couple of months ago he crashed his small plane into an office building in Austin, Texas, committed suicide. He left a manifesto explaining his actions. It was mentioned in the press, mostly ridiculed, but I think it deserves much closer attention. Stack's manifesto describes, he traces the life history that led him to this final desperate act. Story begins when he was a teenage student living on a pittance in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, former industrial area, right near its heart. It's the heart of the industrial center. He had a neighbor. She was a woman in her 80s. She was surviving on cat food. I'll quote him now. She was the widowed wife of a retired steel worker. Her husband had worked all his life in the steel mills of central Pennsylvania with promises from big business and the union that for his 30 years of service, he would have a pension and medical care to look forward to in his retirement. Instead, he was one of the thousands who got nothing, because the mill management and the union, not to mention the government, raided their pension funds and stole their retirement. All that his widowed wife had was Social Security to live on. He could have gone on to say that there are now concerted and persistent efforts by the super rich and their political allies to take even that away on spurious grounds, and that may happen in the next few years. Well, going back to Stack, he decided he couldn't trust big business, and he would strike out on his own. And he soon discovered that he couldn't trust a government that, as he put it, cared nothing about people like him, but only the rich and privileged, or a legal system in which there are two interpretations for every law, one for the very rich and one for the rest of us. He couldn't trust a government that leaves us with the joke we call the American medical system, including the drug and insurance companies that are murdering tens of thousands of people a year with care rationed largely by wealth, not by need. All of this is a social order in which a handful of thugs and plunderers can commit unthinkable atrocities. And when it's time for their gravy train to crash under the weight of their gluttony, the force of the full federal government has no difficulty coming to their aid within hours. and the federal government, of course, means the taxpayer. Stack says that his desperate final act was an effort to show that there are people willing to die for their freedom in the hope of awakening others from their torpor. It wouldn't surprise me, though he didn't say so, if he had in mind the premature death of the steel worker that taught him about the real world when he was a teenager. Now, that steel worker didn't literally commit suicide, as far as we know, but he died quickly after having been discarded to the trash heap, and that's very far from an isolated case. We can add his and many similar deaths to the colossal toll of the institutional crimes of state capitalism. There are poignant studies of the indignation and the rage of those who have been cast aside as the state corporate programs of financialization and deindustrialization have closed plants, destroyed families and communities. Incidentally, rather similar studies of similar reactions in Chinese areas, what's sometimes called the Rust Belt, where similar things are happening. These reveal the sense of acute betrayal on the part of working people who believed that they had fulfilled their duty to society in a kind of a moral compact with business and government, only to discover that they were just instruments of power and profit, cast aside when they were no longer useful. These are truisms from which they had been carefully protected by the doctrinal institutions. While returning, reading Joe Stack's manifesto and all other stuff like it, I do find myself recovering childhood memories and a lot more that I didn't understand at that time. The Weimar Republic, Germany was 20s and early 30s, that was the peak of Western civilization. It's worth remembering that in the sciences, the arts, and literature. It was also regarded as a model of democracy. Through the 1920s, the traditional ruling parties, the liberal and conservative parties, they entered into decline, inexorable decline. And so that was well before the process was intensified by the Great Depression. In 1925, General Hindenburg, Prussian aristocrat, was elected president, and the coalition that elected him was pretty similar to the mass base that swept Hitler into office 8 years later, that compelled the aristocratic Hindenburg to select as chancellor what he called the little corporal, who he despised, but he had to do it because of the mass support. As late as 1928, the Nazis had less than 3% of the vote. 2 years after that, the most respectable Berlin press was lamenting the sight, I'll quote them, of the many millions in this highly civilized country who had given their vote to the commonest, hollowest, and crudest charlatanism. The public was becoming disgusted with the incessant wrangling of Weimar politics, democratic parliamentary politics, and the service of the traditional parties to powerful interests, and their failure to deal with popular grievances. And at the same time, they were being drawn by persuasive forces that were dedicated to upholding the greatness of the nation and defending it against invented threats in a revitalized, armed, unified state, which was marching on to a glorious future, led by the charismatic figure who was carrying out what he called the will of eternal providence, the creator of the universe. That's the way he orated to the mesmerized masses. These are these speeches I was hearing and not understanding, but sort of grasping in some sense back in the mid-30s. By May 1933, the Nazis had largely destroyed not only the traditional ruling parties, but also the huge working class parties, and they were enormous, and also their associations, which were very powerful and rich. They were gone within a few years. The Nazis were declared May Day, 1933, to be a workers' holiday, first time. That was what the big left parties had never been able to achieve. And many working people took part in the enormous patriotic demonstrations on May Day, 1933, more than a million people estimated in the heart of what was called Red Berlin, left-wing working-class city. They joined farmers, artisans, shopkeepers, petty bourgeois, paramilitary forces, Christian organizations, athletic clubs, military clubs, and the whole rest of the coalition that was coalescing as the center very quickly collapsed. By the onset of the war, probably 90% of Germans were marching enthusiastically with the brown shirts. Well, the world's too complex for history to repeat, but there are some unpleasant memories reverberating, and there are lessons to keep in mind. I'll have to expand on them. For those who want to choose the vocation of critical intellectuals, there's no shortage of tasks. That's true whatever their station in life, whether they're called intellectuals or not. They can try to sweep away the mists of carefully contrived illusion and reveal the stark reality, which is often quite simple when you clear away the mists. They can become engaged directly in popular struggles. They can help organize the countless Joe Stacks who are destroying themselves and maybe the world, and they could join them in leading the way to a better future. Thanks.